Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening and welcome to this edition of Blog Business Success here on Blog Talk Radio. And I'm your host, Wayne Hurlburt. And tonight our guests are Pamela Rutledge and Bonnie Buckner. And they're both adjunct faculty at the Fielding Graduate University. And they're also the co-founders of AthinkLab. And Pamela Rutledge and Bonnie Buckner are also course instructors at UC Irvine Extension, where they're teaching a course in transmedia marketing through storytelling. And they describe the importance of psychology to transmedia marketing, and also they'll demonstrate how storytelling is a viable strategy for enhancing audience engagement. And you'll also discover why transmedia storytelling is the future of marketing. As I'd mentioned earlier, Pamela Rutledge is a media psychologist who is passionate about helping people and organizations understand the way communications and technologies change our culture, psychology, and behavior. And her perspective is encapsulated in what AthinkLab calls learning to see. Pam believes that by understanding how things work, we can more successfully achieve our own goals. Bonnie Buckner has been teaching people and businesses techniques for expanding perception, creativity, and innovation for over 5 years. She's worked in and studied the culture and system of business as an entrepreneur for over a decade. And Bonnie believes that we are living in a time of shifting paradigms that create opportunities for reimagining our communities, how we advocate and govern, and the role of business. Welcome to our show, Pam and Bonnie.
Thank you so much. It's wonderful to be here.
Thank you, Wayne.
Oh, you're very welcome, and I've been looking forward to speaking with you as well. And you've created a course at the University of California, Irvine Extension called Transmedia Marketing Through Storytelling. What was the background to creating this course?
Well, Pam and I are both media psychologists, which is sort of an interesting phrase, which basically means that we study psychologies and cultures that are shifting due to changes in media. And then those shifts, in turn, shape media and so on and so forth. And we see that, to us, we're living in an age that we like to compare to the time when the printing press was invented. At that time, there was suddenly this mass literacy, and an entire culture suddenly learned to read, meant that they had access to information and voice in a different way. And this caused massive societal shifts. There was the creation of a new religion, the breaking down of aristocracy and principalities, and the society completely restructured due to what individuals could then do. And today we have a similar time. You mentioned that I believe we're in a time of shifting paradigms, and I do. And what we mean by that is we have two things happening. We have a sudden mass access to information, and we also have the means to disseminate it on levels that have never been known to history. So non-specialist people have access to specialized information, like I could download right now legal forms to start my own company, for example. And we can also reach hundreds of thousands of people as an individual with our individual voice. And this makes for a very different person. There's a new psychology, so to speak, of empowerment and engagement, and it influences our culture and society. So we see that coming forth in things like the recent revolution that started in Tunisia and has swept across the Middle East, which got traction from a Facebook post. And transmedia storytelling for us is sort of a child of these changes. And Pam and I are very passionate about its role in this new networked world, as we call it. And so we approached UCI with this idea of a course. And it was one of the first, if not the first, to do that. And so it was something that Melanie had to go to bat for us because nobody had heard of it before. But they really liked the idea and the marketing potential of it and the unique twist that we took to it, which is taking transmedia storytelling to branding and marketing and advocacy. And so they went with it. And we're now in our second semester, and it's really, it's picking up a lot of steam across the country, not just with UCI.
When you use the term transmedia marketing, what do you mean by that concept? And why is it so important for people to understand its meaning and its potential?
Well, Wayne, if we separate that into the two terms, transmedia and marketing, transmedia just means things that are going across media. And this really isn't a new concept. We communicate, we have relationships, we do all of these things in a transmedia way. You and I have a transmedia relationship because we've talked on the radio and we've talked by email. So we have already established a relationship that's transmedia. The important thing about transmedia when we think about marketing, however, and what we think is really important is that because there's so many avenues to communicate, that you have to have a very coherent message because of all of this noise that's out there. There's too many avenues if you aren't concentrated on what you're trying to say. It's just bits all over the place. So the whole point of marketing strategy is to have a cohesive message, but this is just a much more multidimensional perspective. And if you can think this way, it totally changes how you construct your marketing strategy.
And just to maybe jump in, Wayne, to give an example of what a transmedia story would look like for everybody before we get further into the questions, one of the things that Pam and I like to do as an example is talk about the story of the three little pigs. So if the three little pigs was a transmedia story, you would look at it that you would have a main story anchor medium. So in this case, it would be, for example, a novel. And then you would have maybe the wolf having a companion website that would give us opportunities to learn more about him, the mathematics schematics of the impact of wind velocity on straw, sticks, and bricks. Maybe he would post on that website maps of the turnip field, the apple tree, the country fair, and the different strategic attack positions. And we could follow him with different posts to his site as he plots and adjusts his plans in response to the pigs. And then on a blog, maybe the first little pig details family history, paranoid suspicions of a dark figure lurking about the house that led to the decision for the pigs to even leave and live separately rather than together. The second little pig maybe tweets his chronicle. He seeks advice on sustainable building materials and the merits of straw and sticks. And as it begins to heat up, he would maybe relay breaking news, you know, at little pig two, walls of house bowing inward, sticks flying off roof, help. While the third little pig may have a cooking series that's shot on location from the Stonehouse kitchen. And he can post it on YouTube with ways to make parsley turnips, baked apples, and stewed wolf surprise, for example. So these are some of the ways they can take a story and then begin to lay it out in ways that add to the greater narrative and allow different points of entry for different people.
No, because if you take that example and you think about that as a business, essentially what we've done with the three little pigs is that we've given you all of these multiple viewpoints of the three little pigs. So while it might not seem relevant for a pig to have a cooking show, what it is doing is showing you that personality, that side of this whole story. And so that's what we want to do for businesses and advocacy groups and nonprofits, is to really have their story be very rich, so that because different people relate to different parts of stories. So what you're trying to do is make the story that's very rich. And one thing that's very brilliant about the whole transmedia storytelling thing is that part of this new psychology is that people want to help in the story. They want to participate. I mean, everything from reviews on TripAdvisor to people participating in fan fiction and on forums. So if you have a good story, even as a business, people will help participate with that story if you set it up right. So it's incredibly powerful and engaging once you get people to buy in as a stakeholder to the message and the story that you're delivering.
You describe transmedia marketing as a 360-degree marketing strategy. Does that tie in very well with the storytelling approach that you've been discussing?
The 360-degree marketing strategy really does start with a story basis, we believe. So if you think about it this way, in the past, marketing has been sort of, maybe to put it crassly, jingle-based, you know, buy this, hire us. And it was sort of put out in this one-way channel from business to potential customer. And if you listen to an ad on the radio, it either grabbed you or it didn't. And 360-degree marketing, what we mean by that is stepping back from the jingle and starting with the story of the company. You know, what is the essence of the company, the passion that was the genesis that set it in motion? Every company has a story. And, a lot of companies don't realize that, but businesses start with a passion for an idea, and then that idea becomes a story. So the first step is to go back to what is that essence of the company. And then by finding that, it's telling the story in a transmedia way. Like Pam was just talking about, doing it in a transmedia way means thinking about, I have customers that have really unique needs, and some of my customers' needs are going to be better met by different aspects of my company. And so you can also look at that as there's different ways to then reach those customers. There are people who take very much to Twitter. There are other people who like to check in with Facebook posts. There are other people who like to read in depth or who like to participate. You know, back to the first thing we were talking about of individuals having a voice, participation is a very, very big need that people have today. So 360 means stepping really into the customer's shoes and looking at the different unique needs of different groups of your customers and how that relates to different aspects of your company and meeting them in that place where it becomes more of a dialogue than a static one-to-one, you know, from business to individual sort of conversation. And an example of that is really like the American Red Cross. So after Katrina, there was a lot of negative talk in the whole blogosphere and Twitter sphere about Red Cross and other government agencies and what a bad job they did. And Red Cross was concerned partly because people thought they did a bad job and they didn't want to, but also because they thought that a lot of it was based on misinformation. So they started to monitor a lot of social media and respond to it personally when they saw negative comments. And this had a huge impact on public opinion. And from there, they hired people and a social media manager and really dove into it in a big way. And they have a very robust community now. And what they really get is an essential point of transmedia storytelling, which is that relationships have value. They send out information, and they're looking at ways to connect with people in a value-driven way as opposed to just simply always asking, you know, give money, give money. And one of the examples is they have a new geolocated app that locates shelters nearest to you from any GPS smartphone. And this gives something of value, and it also gives that person a way to give value to someone else. You know, here, I put this app on your phone, so if we ever have a tornado now, you'll also know where to find shelter.
Yeah, another example of that is Pet Airways, which started in 2009 as a dog and cat only airline. And so they've really developed this whole story around taking care of pets. And so some of the ways they've fleshed out their story is by affiliations with animal rescue societies and events that way, and blogs talking about how to care for animals, and a Facebook page where you can post stories about your animals and your concerns about traveling with your animals. And they provide all kinds of information and various things like that, so that you have this sense that they're all not just a slogan, but a company that really cares about your animal. So you've got this relationship with the concept, and, you know, animals are really important to a lot of people. So by giving you that level of value and connection, you've created, in a sense, an obligation. It's kind of you giving them value, so they kind of owe you in that mafia kind of way. But that's how relationships work. You know, there's a, you're driven by reciprocity, and it's not a negative thing. It's a biologically wired response. So that's a way to engage people, is by helping them first. And it's very powerful.
One of the features of transmedia marketing storytelling that you've mentioned already and is part of the course outline is psychology. Why is psychology so key to understanding transmedia storytelling as part of that social engagement?
Well, this is like you're asking psychologists why psychology is important. So we think psychology is important to absolutely everything. But what psychology allows us to do is to really look at what's going on in a human being, both individually and as a group. And it used to be that we sort of in our minds kept the media and all this technology sort of over in one bucket and then people in the other, as if they really didn't interact much. But now everyone realizes that the technology is integrated into our lives in a very meaningful way. So the psychology of media, understanding how individual psychology responds to media, is very important to marketing. And it's especially important in this new environment because people's perspectives and assumptions and expectations have really changed due to social media networking. But another key to the psychology in transmedia storytelling is that storytelling is a very basic way of transferring information. Our brains work by taking information and turning them into a story. It's how we make things into patterns. Everything we do, we translate into story. That's how we remember it. And our brains were developed layer at a time, kind of like the Winchester house. You know, we started with the lizard brain, and instead of just remodeling the whole thing, we just sort of laid on another room, the mammalian brain, and then when I guess we ran out of space, you know, we put on the neocortex. And so the neocortex is the part of their thinking, and that's the part that thinks it's in charge, right? But the other two parts are responding to all of this data in the universe, all of the sensory data, smells, and all of these things, and they release chemicals that then the neocortex has to interpret to make sense out of, and it puts it into a story. But the real input first comes in at a much more basic level. And that's why stories are so powerful, because they really engage us at all three levels of the brain. I mean, one way to demonstrate that easily is to have everyone imagine that I have a very large lemon. So if you can picture that lemon, and then I'm going to cut that lemon in half. And then I'm going to squeeze the lemon. I'm going to squeeze it out into a spoon. And then I'm going to offer that spoon to you to take a sip. Now, for most people, just visualizing all that, I'm even salivating, it causes physical reactions. As you imagine the lemon, as you know what it tastes like, as you can see it, as you think about maybe when you had a lemon last, boy, I really like veal piccata, or I just love summer because of lemonade, or maybe you think, oh my gosh, you know, it's, you know, making my nose crinkle up. All of those things aren't happening because of your neocortex. They're happening because of your lizard and mammalian brains. So stories are a way of tapping into that very basic level, and that's part of what psychology brings, is an understanding of that combination of neurology and chemicals and thinking and behavior.
So,
Wayne, did you taste the lemon?
Yes, I could almost taste that sour delight already.
Go ahead, Bonnie. I'm sorry.
No, that's fine. So, you know, and to kind of underscore what Pam is saying, if you think about life from the perspective of your brain, it's going along and it's just having a bombardment of information that comes in from the senses. So it's smelling, it's tasting, it's feeling, it's listening, and it's seeing the world. And so all of that chaotic jumble then travels through the nerves to the brain, and it actually becomes an image and many different images. And then from there, we have to make it make sense to us. And then we have to make decisions based on that information. So stories are that making sense of it. And stories become written into our brain in a sense of what we like to call frames. So if you think about, for example, Rocky, right? So there was that great moment, the montage, where Rocky is training, and he's doing this great improvement, and he's running through the streets, and then he ends that montage by running up. You know, he's breathing heavy, but he's doing it, and he gets to the very top of the stairs, and he starts jumping up and down as a champion. So we see Rocky as a champion. And then later in the big fight, he's getting pummeled. But we've already seen him as a champion. And so we're looking to, you know, we get into feeling him and moving with him, and we feel the sweat, and we feel the pain of being hit. And then suddenly that becomes a triumph. He has that rally moment, and he triumphs. I can take that whole thing and describe that in one word, which is underdog. So the other thing that our brain does, it not only makes it organizes and makes sense of the sensory information, it then creates little shortcuts. And shortcuts are narrative frames. So I can look at underdog, and I very quickly have made sense of a very complex story. That can be both good and bad, by the way. One of the examples of how that becomes relevant to a company and a corporation or an advocacy cause, I was telling Pam just the other night, there was a move in California a couple of years ago to make it illegal to sell raw milk. And part of that move was sponsored by the very large commercial milk companies that pasteurize milk. And some government officials that sat on the agricultural board and things like that, that had, you know, dealings in that. So there are two very small family-owned companies in California that sell raw milk, just two. And what they put out to fight this and all of their marketing materials was basically the underdog story. You know, look, we're two small, they joined forces, and they said, we're two small family-owned companies, and the big, giant corporation that has all this money and all this funding is going to hire better lawyers than us, and they're going to pummel us. But we believe in our milk. We believe in what we do. And they got a couple of children who had severe milk allergies until they had started drinking raw milk to tell their story. You know, I was really sick until mommy started buying me raw milk. And so they had a huge, huge push of support, of people sending in letters and who really got behind that. And when the day came for it to show up in court, you know, a lot of these things happen in courts all the time and nobody really shows up except for the attorneys and the people from the company who are being called to task. And it was flooded. There were people pouring out of the courthouse when this was deliberated, and they won. So that's an example of how a company can take a very common, understood narrative frame and use it as part of their story.
Because if you look at the story that Bonnie just told, I mean, if you take away all the embellishment about, you know, who it was and all of that, you're really talking about one of those universal storylines. I mean, you're talking about David and Goliath. You're talking about a whole history in Western civilization of stories with that archetype. And when you tap into that, you tap into that sort of little basket of information that Bonnie was referring to that's already living in your brain. So it's like broadband for the brain. You don't have to explain all that stuff. People just know it. And so if you can tap into that, you just told them a whole bunch of stuff without having to tell them, which is why story is so powerful.
Is understanding psychology of storytelling used in different ways across different social media platforms? For example, is it used differently on Twitter, Facebook, YouTube, LinkedIn, and so on? Or are there commonalities to all of the platforms?
When we look at these things through psychology, the first thing we want to do is figure out what's the goal that we want to accomplish, obviously. And then we start to look at the tools that we have to use. Now, the psychology doesn't change, but what changes is the capabilities of different tools. So depending upon who our audience is and what the story or the message is and what we're trying to accomplish, we might choose to use different tools. So we might use Twitter if we were sending out snippets of valuable information or special deals or coupons to a crowd that we had already researched as being to use Twitter. But if we were sending out long-term life insurance policy advertisements for elder care, we probably wouldn't use Twitter. You know, for two reasons. One is that it's hard to follow, and as she says with her glasses on, as you get older, your eyesight gets worse. So you take all kinds of things into consideration. The ease of use, the physical development, the experience of using something, and you match up all of these criteria based upon your psychological assessment of different tools with the goal and the target audience. So you match those up with what you know about psychology.
For marketers, what challenges does this new marketing strategy of the psychology of storytelling and transmedia pose for traditional marketers and their techniques?
Well, the first thing they have to do is understand that the rules have changed. I mean, that's really true. And for anybody who believes they're controlling their message or they're controlling their brand, they are not. The brand lives in the brains of the consumers. Biggest difference is now the consumers can all talk to each other. So for a traditional marketer, you have to step back and think about the model that the base assumptions for your strategy. What's the model that I'm assuming? What am I assuming about how I'm reaching people? Because what we usually tell people when word advising on social media is, who's saying what about you? I mean, we go out and we actually do the research. We listen. We listen to what people are saying about their company or their product. We listen to what the people who are in that demographic are saying. We try and understand their sort of purpose and needs in life, not just how many eggs do they buy in a week. So we really look at these people as whole, because one of the fundamental criteria of this social media change is that people want humanity. We're connected one-to-one everywhere. We don't have to be a big lump anymore. You want your information personalized, and you can get your own information personalized. You can pull anything you want to you. You can go on Amazon and price shop. You can do all of these things in a very personal way. So the last thing you want is some big lump of homogeneous material coming to you from a company. That tells you they don't care. Whether or not that's true or not, it doesn't matter, because that's the perception from the consumer side. So traditional marketers don't abandon your tools. Figure out what it is the tools can do in this new environment and adjust them.
There's also a really big thing right now, we've talked about that people want to participate. And one of the very big aspects about transmedia storytelling is participation. And that's not something that old corporate models have really been, have allowed for. It's always been, you know, here's the company and they're going to make something and people will either buy it or they won't. One example of a company not being fluid enough is the TV show Mad Men. One of the very enthusiastic fans of that show created a fake character and a Twitter account with that character and had that character in a full story that was part of the series of Mad Men. And it had a huge following, and people were really into it. And the producers got very upset, and there was a legal suit to get them to stop, to cease and desist. And that's a real opportunity lost because people really got into it, and it was additive. It wasn't subtractive. And so one of the things that is part and parcel to what Pam is saying about the humanity is recognizing that it's really, it's not a monologue, it's a dialogue. And there's a lot of room for consumer input into the company. Just like with the Red Cross example, they were fluid and flexible, and they adapted. They listened and heard what their customers and what people were saying about them, and they responded to that.
And, of course, we've seen many examples in recent years of people creating their own alternative advertisements for various products on YouTube. They're showing uses of different products and services on YouTube, discussing them on Facebook, setting up fan pages and all those sorts of things. Originally, many companies were objecting to that sort of behavior, but now they're embracing it and inviting it.
As well they should. I mean,
they should.
What better way to find out what your customers want than to have them talk about it? I mean, it's like you know, the best focus group in the world.
And not only focus group, that just expands your marketing to every single person who's going to contact them in whatever way. If they're going to, you know, go on YouTube and see this, or they're going to pick up the Twitter feeds, that they become marketers. And so, you know, one of the things that Pam and I like to say is transmedia storytelling is really a way to turn people into advocates for your company, not just customers.
Yes, I've long been an advocate myself of customer advocacy and of letting go of the concept of control, as you were mentioning, and your discussion so far has been confirming all of the things that I've been supporting for quite a few years now.
Yeah, well, you had a foresight. A lot of people still don't understand, and it's remarkable to see all of this connection all over the world and not to be able to extrapolate it back to your business. And it's so important, and it makes such a better environment, because every person who works in your business, whether it's big or small, is a marketing person because they talk to people. And even if they're sweeping the shop floor, that guy talks about his job and his company to people, you know, at the grocery store, at the gas station, you know, at home. Everyone out there is essentially a marketing voice. And so if people feel heard within the company, and that's one of the really powerful things that Bonnie and I like about the helping a company find their story, is that when you involve the people in a company to find a story, to get back to that passion, you also start to hear the stories that people have that don't match. And you can find out where people have been sort of marching off in different directions. So once you get a story that everyone sort of acknowledges and is excited about, you've harnessed an incredible amount of energy that had been working in a very disparate way.
You know,
yes,
not only
is everyone in the organization in marketing, but they're also in public relations, customer service, and they're the face of the organization to everyone who knows them and who they speak to. You may only know one person in that particular Fortune 50 company, but that person is the face of the organization as far as you're concerned, and it's the part of the story that you hear.
Exactly.
It is. We actually had a student who was so enthused about his company, which was a really large telecom company, that he created a blog to talk about all the cool things that his company is doing. And I went on the blog and we looked at it, and there were also postings of his family, his daughters, and we asked him about it, and he said, oh, yeah, well, you know, the blog is really just about everything that's important in my life. And that blog is going out to all of his family and friends, and it that's an example of the kind of employee you really want that has the same vision for the company that the company has for itself, and who's out there making it just an organic part of their life.
You've described transmedia storytelling as the future of marketing. Why do you say that?
Well, it kind of goes back to, today there's just messages everywhere you go, and there's so much information available that it really becomes this chaotic jumble. And the real scarcity today is relevance. And stories convey relevance. It's really the future of marketing because it's a way for companies and causes to be heard in today's information world.
And, of course, while the terms of transparency and authenticity are fast becoming so ubiquitous that they're becoming buzzwords, they're still important in that authenticity represents being real and being yourself and being a human face on that screen or whichever media you're using, and that transparency represents that insight into what's really going on within the organization, its products and services.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you're absolutely right. They're turning into buzzwords, and it's too bad. They do get tossed around a lot, but it is what makes a relationship meaningful is that you can trust it. I mean, you could call it trust as well as you could call it transparency is the sort of old, what you see is what you get. And in a way, it kind of takes us back to the days of a deal on a handshake because you're making relationships between people and you need to be able to trust them. 75% of America is online. And most of them trust social media for a recommendation more than advertising. So what you're trying to do is elevate your status to that of a friend, so that you're a trusted source, and you can't be a trusted source if you aren't honest.
But you also, there's been a lot of, LinkedIn groups and discussion groups and things like that that have thrown around, here's how to be a transparent business. And I remember reading one that really stuck out at me, and it was a very prescribed model where the guy was advocating that the company look at what their shortcomings were, massage it so that it's not quite such a shortcoming, and then put that out because by putting out a shortcoming makes it seem like they're really willing to be transparent. It's sort of like that old interview question of, what is your greatest shortcoming? And you try and figure out before you go into the interview, how can I make that a positive, And that's still controlling. That's not real transparency. But today, we have such means to information. It's like everybody's pulling the curtain off the wizard. And so being really transparent doesn't mean massaging message and showing a little bit of your Achilles heel. It means really being transparent. And it means having a full, vulnerable conversation with the customer. If the customer comes back and says, it doesn't work for me that XYZ, I'll go back to Red Cross because we've already talked about it, then be vulnerable enough to hear that and to respond to it and be responsive.
I always consider feedback from people, whether they're customers or not, to be a gift offered to the organization of a way to do things better, to provide a change in their product and service line instead of that old defense of, well, our product is equal to or just slightly above perfection, and it's you that's the problem.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think there are some companies that really understand the idea of this change in the environment that means customer service, like you were saying, has to be everyone in the company. A perfect example of that is cited all the time is Zappos, where every person in that company, well, the company mission is to provide happiness. It isn't about shoes at all. And if you have any customer service issue and you call Zappos, the person that answers the phone has the authority to fix your problem. I just recently tried to buy a washer and dryer from Sears. I probably talked to 15 or 20 customer service people. They were lovely. Not a one of them could fix my problem. That's, you know, they got the first part about being nice, but they didn't understand about the ability to actually fix the problem or the expectation that things need to happen a little bit faster. You know, I can send an email out and get an answer the next day. I don't want to wait 3 weeks to find out that they ordered the wrong washing machine. So it happens at a lot of levels. So I think a lot of companies don't do that kind of archaeology in their own company to see how it really works all the way down.
And that goes back to the concept that I think is 100% wrong, that customer service is seen as an expense and not a benefit to the organization, because as soon as you take the Zappos approach where you make a customer who has a complaint or a problem happy, that person, instead of being a person who's angry at you, suddenly turns around as one of your strongest customer evangelists you'll ever find, because they'll say, hey, look, I had a problem and this company made it right.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, no, and then they go the extra mile, and that's what people, life doesn't always go smoothly. We all know that, but we all want to be treated as an individual that matters. That's what customer service job is.
And not going to some manual that says on page 175, paragraph 4, section 3, subsection 2 says you get absolutely nothing.
That's right. That's
right.
True. You've talked to those call centers before, have you?
Yes, unfortunately, we all have had that experience in life, haven't we?
Yeah, we have.
We have.
It appears, of course, that social media is here to stay. Why are so many marketers reluctant to use social media? And if they do use it, they want to use it in the old-fashioned broadcast technique way, where instead of engaging with the customers, they just simply point out, if you want X, buy it from us. If you want Y, buy it from us, and so on.
I think there's a few reasons there. I think it goes back again to what we've been talking about control. There's, one of the slow demographics to enter Facebook that then became one of the fastest growing, largest demographics is the older demographic. And when you talk to a lot of those people, they say, well, I just don't like everything about me up for public display. And I think that, you know, obviously the digital native doesn't feel that way at all. They have profiles everywhere. They're an open book. They're easily accessible. And most of the people who are running companies are probably of that older model. There's a changing – Facebook has been remarkable because it's changing people's definitions and understandings of privacy. And privacy folds right into what we're talking about authenticity, about transparency. And so I think one of the problems that companies have with social media is they feel like there's a loss of control there, that it's out there. And, some of the people that we've worked with before have said, well, we'd like to have a bigger social media presence, but what do you do when people post something negative? And they all want to, have that ability to not post the negative posts. And that's not how it works. And so I think there's a lot of fear from that level. And I think there's also this idea that it requires a lot more of a daily focus. You know, there's a lot of people who hire companies to handle their social media, but social media starts to get down to something that's really real, and it gets harder and harder to farm out. I had a past student just send me an email today who interviewed with an organization that used one of those companies, and they felt like being out of the company and being so far removed from the company was really a disservice for them. And so they're bringing all of their social media in-house. So that means to a company, you also have to then create a department. So I think there's a few different barriers to entry for companies that are both psychological and then just the physical that make them reticent to jump into social media.
And let me, to say what Bonnie was talking about, just add an example of this sort of lack of control that the companies who can take something that happens negative and respond to it in a positive and creative way end up creating more good out of it than bad. Recently, someone who worked for Red Cross accidentally tweeted out on the Red Cross Twitter instead of their own personal Twitter account about, you know, finding some more beer and about how they were, you know, when they drink, they do it right. And the Red Cross responded, well, they did delete that tweet, but what they said is, we've deleted the rogue tweet, but rest assured that the Red Cross is sober and we've confiscated the key. So they handled it in such a clever way that it got retweeted all over the place. So I thought that was a very good example of somebody understanding that this is sort of a new environment and it's okay to play with it a little. One thing I wanted to say to follow up on what Bonnie was talking about this distance in social media, for any of your listeners that are small business people, don't be discouraged by this idea that it's all big and complicated and takes a lot of time and money. Social media doesn't have to be like that. I mean, first of all, people make the mistake of thinking, if I'm going to do social media, I have to have all of these outlets. You don't. What you have to do is figure out which one works for you. And once you figure that out, then you can manage that one. You can manage that easily by yourself. And it's free, and you can't get that kind of leverage. And perfect example of that are the food trucks, these sort of gourmet food trucks that have sprung up all over due to the extraordinary success of the Kobe Tacos or
Kobe truck, Kobe barbecue.
Yeah,
truck.
The Kobe truck in LA, and some of these where they got followers on Twitter who look for their location based upon Twitter's. Another company sold like ski boarding equipment, and they were having a very hard time marketing, and they were selling to ski shops and stuff until they figured out that the people who actually bought their stuff were on Facebook. So they set up an e-commerce site, put a page with not with their equipment, but with radical skiing videos. And they got a huge following on Facebook, and then people were excited about seeing all these videos and the skiing, and then they went to their site and bought their stuff. So they understood the environment, they understood their audience, they understood you have to deliver value. Whether they had a Twitter account or not didn't matter. So it's for small business, it's the best thing that ever happened.
I see social media as the great equalizer for the small business as they compete against very deep-pocketed, large multi-billion-dollar corporations. You have that same access to followers and to follow other people on Twitter as the largest company in the world, and you also have that same access on Facebook as well. You're in an equal place.
Oh, that's exactly right. And the things that attract people's attention and go viral, as it's called, that spread around a lot, have nothing to do with budget. They have to do with spirit and creativity. And, you know, it's a great, as you say, it's a great equalizer. It's really letting people show who they are and judging them on that.
And, you know, to add to that, about a month or so ago on NPR's program Left, Right, and Center, Arianna Huffington was suggesting that she believes that one of the things to come out of the recession is going to be a rise of new businesses that wouldn't have been possible before, but are now thanks to social media, and that that is going to be where the growth and the recovery happens. And I don't disagree. In fact, Pam was talking about the Kogi truck. What's interesting about that is the story. And it was started by two guys who grew up here in L.A. and were working at big companies. And they were chefs, and one guy was the business guy. And they had a lot of ideas and a lot of creativity. But to have an opportunity to really express that in that big company, it wasn't going to happen. And to go out and start their own four-star restaurant wasn't going to happen because it's too much money, and they just didn't have it. And so one night they were sitting around brainstorming, and the business guy said, you know, you do all this funky stuff. The chef was Korean, but he had grown up here in L.A. where the taco trucks have been sort of ubiquitous for a long time. He goes, could you do like a Korean taco truck? And he goes, yeah, you know what? I think I could. And that's where the story started, and that's where people really got into it. And once they bought the Kogi truck and came up with their menu, the first place they parked it was outside of a bar around 10 o'clock when people start to get the munchies, I suppose, and nobody was coming up to the truck. And so they said, okay, we're going to give out tacos for free. And they just started going through the bar, giving out tacos for free. And within an hour, there was a huge line that was spreading down the block. And everybody in that line had their phone out, and they were texting or tweeting about, oh, my gosh, you've got to try this Kogi truck. And that's really where it was born. So, you know, not only is social media going to be a place that the small business owner can start to compete, it's also a place where people's creativity can flourish. And, you know, it also sort of points to the power of story with that example, too.
And as we all know, small business people are able to move quickly and be very nimble on their feet, and they can move around like Jack meeting up against the giant very quickly and smoothly, and the giant topples over and falls down the beanstalk because he moves slowly and lumbering, and he has to go through all these processes and channels to do anything.
Exactly.
Yeah.
As you've already pointed out, transmedia storytelling is the marketing wave of the future. What other trends do you see in transmedia marketing along with the storytelling aspect?
Well, first we have to say, you know, transmedia, like we said earlier, isn't really new. It's just a shift of awareness to this new set of platforms that we have to use, this new portfolio of communication devices. That isn't going to change. But what will change is the tools that are available within that, and what will also change is the borders between them. Things start to become more fluid, so that I think we're going to start to see more blending of technologies. For one example is that I think that mobile is going to be even bigger than it is now. A lot of markets are way more than half mobile. The Hispanic market right now is the largest user of cell phones and smartphones, and a lot of companies that speak with them, like ESPN and the National Baseball League and all companies that have a big following in that community, have created mobile-friendly websites so that they're very easy to access from a phone. So I think we're going to see a shift towards things that work mobily. I also think we're going to, because things are going to go mobile, we're going to start seeing things that are multiple media within a media. In Japan right now, there's a trend that's called the Kitai novels, and there's a story that builds week by week, but one week it might be a video, and the next week it might be text, and then it might be a little puzzle, and then it might be a picture. So you sort of put together this story out of these little bits, and so the whole thing becomes a puzzle in a manner of speaking. So there, I think there'll be lots of ways, creative ways that people can put together different kinds of media. The one thing that's not going to change is this, the ability of people to talk to each other. One way that comes in and can be very exciting is when things that are electronic actually come out into the real world. Things like alternate reality games, where someone will invent a game that you actually play in the real world. And there have been some of those that are sort of halfway blended between fantasy and reality. There was a fabulous fundraising effort to get books to poor children in Africa built around a fictional, almost spy story that people were tracking on their computers. But as they played the game, they also sent real books. So there's going to be a lot of this sort of blended reality. But I think ultimately people don't want to wander around looking at the world through a phone. So we're going to get the technology is going to become more and more transparent.
And in the end, the old basics of the country general store of doing business with those who you know, like, and trust will always prevail, even with the most high-tech applications and media systems and technology.
Absolutely. I mean, the one thing that people forget when they're busy, you know, thinking that Facebook is the devil, is that none of this stuff exists without people. And people haven't changed all that much. All of these things are just facilitating goals that people want to accomplish. And we're still learning the rules to a lot of this technology, so sometimes we do some dumb things. But basically, we're still all trying to connect with people, feed our families, make the world a better place. Get smarter, make the world better for our children. We're doing all those same things that we've always done. So you're absolutely right that the things that are core importance, it's just technology is not changing any of it.
And to add to what Pam is saying, the World Wide Web seems really big and really infinite, but it becomes very small very quickly when you group together with people, when you have the basis of a like interest. So the minute you join a chat room and say, hey, I'm interested in this very specific kind of guitar, then you've narrowed your world to that little mom-and-pop sort of store. And all of the people who are experts in that kind of guitar, who are really passionate about it, they're, in a way, instant friends and instantly familiar because you have that as your base. And so that becomes that trusted place where you go and say, okay, now that I've learned all about it, where do I get it? And then that recommendation is going to drive, where you go and where you buy.
And for the mom-and-pop business, instead of the market just being their local neighborhood or even their own city, is now the entire world because anything can be shipped anywhere at any time. So if a person is missing out on being part of transmedia, they're missing out on an opportunity to be a global company from a very tiny location.
Absolutely.
Exactly.
What is the first step that a marketer should take toward becoming an effective and engaging transmedia storyteller?
Well, the first step is finding your company story. And that can actually be easier than you think. My attorney, for example, came to me and said, I'm just a lawyer. What do I do? What's my story? And he told me a lot about what he does and all these documents and things. And it was kind of a snore. And then I said, okay, so now you've told us, what you do. How do you feel about your company? And he thought for a minute, and then he said, well, this may sound silly, but I kind of picture myself as a family doctor that specializes in preventative medicine. And he said he sees himself as the person that takes somebody through all the stages of their life, from starting their own company to preparing wills and family trusts, and that he wants to be the person that can make your whole life a healthy one from a legal standpoint, that you don't just come to him when you're sick, like when you're being sued or you're in a bind. So very quickly, when you start to dig under what we're told we need to stick on a PowerPoint and send out and get to the feeling place, you can find company stories, and that's where companies should start and marketers should start.
And what is next for Pamela Rutledge and Bonnie Buckner?
Well, we actually conduct workshops for companies and organizations on finding their own company story. We use our story openings method for that. And then we also conduct workshops on transmedia storytelling for branding and advocacy, so companies can take either independently or together. And we also consult with companies, working with people in their company to bring that story to company executives.
Well, thanks. And how can we find you on the internet?
Just thinklab.com. Just a thinklab. All smashed together like a good website should be.
Without hyphens, dashes, underscores,
yeah,
and all
right,
those things that people forget to put
right,
in.
A thinklab, but don't forget the A, because otherwise you end up in a guy who does something else.
Yes, as I always say, those underscores in various names on Twitter are going to be the end of me, because I always forget to put them in and wind up looking at a Twitter for somebody who has absolutely nothing to do with
right.
the person I actually wanted.
Right. You can Google Pamela Rutledge and Bonnie Buckner, and you'll end up in the same place.
Well, that's great. And thanks so much for taking the time to speak with us tonight about this fascinating topic. It's been a lot of fun discussing it.
Oh, cool. Well,
thank
it's
you.
Been great for us. You know, your viewers have any questions that come to you, don't hesitate to get in touch with us.
Well, I'll certainly make sure that I keep you in mind and recommend you as often as possible. And thanks to everyone for tuning in to this edition of Blog Business Success here on Blog Talk Radio. And tonight our guests were Pamela Rutledge and Bonnie Buckner. And they're co-founders of Athink Lab. And they're also course instructors at UC Irvine Extension, where they're teaching a course in transmedia marketing through storytelling. Thanks again for joining us tonight, Pam and Bonnie.
Our pleasure.
Thank you. Yeah, thank you so much.
You're very welcome, and thanks to everyone for tuning in. Good night.